and the Carnegie Museum, of course, and the Frick Museum in Pittsburgh. Well, our best paintings have gone to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem and the Tel Aviv Museum. Among our best, the best paintings that we have acquired were three 17th century Dutch masters. And the best Dutch 17th century Dutch master hangs in the Tel Aviv Museum. And one of equal quality hangs in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And the third one is at the Fogg Museum at Harvard. Pictures from our collection have been shown in all the great museums in the United States, starting with the Museum of Modern Art, Boston Museum, San Francisco Museum, New Orleans Museum, Richmond, Virginia, Washington, D.C., wherever, of course, Carnegie Museum, many, many of them, so on and so forth. We have shown all over.
Did you have them in your home first, or did you just buy the pictures for the museum?
No, I bought them for myself. I only gave them later. To a museum, you can't just buy them from a museum.
I see.
If you've got something they want, they come after you.
I see.
They come after you, I can assure you. I can't tell you how many museums have come after that picture there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I wanted to tell you about that particular picture there. Max Pechstein was a German painter who lived at the end of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, who was interested in after the post-impressionist period, there were some movements away from that and beyond that, into abstractionism and so on and so forth. Van Gogh, who died in 1889 or something like that, had never sold a painting in his whole life, and nobody knew Van Gogh. His brother told him he sold two paintings. His brother was an art dealer in Amsterdam, but he never sold. He just sent him the money and told him he sold two paintings. Nobody ever bought a Van Gogh. They didn't like that kind of painting. It was Pechstein who was taken by Van Gogh and by Gauguin. And Pechstein began to look into their paintings, and he introduced the paintings. He formed a group in Germany called Die Brücke, the bridge. And he was the leader of Die Brücke. And they introduced the paintings of Van Gogh and, what's his name?
Gauguin.
Into Germany, see, with a group called Die Brücke. It is my opinion, I bought this particular painting, which is called Sunflowers by Pechstein, painted in 1948 and shown in the Carnegie International of 1950. No painting in the Carnegie International could be more than 3 years old, you know. It's always the best of the very latest thing. And it is my opinion that it's so much, the size is practically exactly the same as Van Gogh's. The subject certainly is the same, with the one exception is he has a few of the butterfly, of the sunflower leaves on the table. Van Gogh didn't have that, see? But I am of the opinion that he did this because it would have been the 50th, the 100th anniversary of Van Gogh's birth.
Uh-huh.
In 1950, or 51, would have been the 100th anniversary. And I'm quite, this is my opinion, see? Since then, of course, right now, for example, there's going to be this tremendous sale at Christie's, November the 14th and the 15th. They want me to put this into the sale.
Okay.
And our Van Manck, we have a very famous Van Manck painting, too, by Van Manck. But we have quite a few that are rather famous, you know, and so on and so forth. But anyway, I haven't
seen it. Have you considered giving this to the Carnegie Institute?
No. So, I haven't, in the first place, this now belongs to my son, and the Van Manck belongs to my daughter. And the Gainsborough, my daughter has, and my son has the Miro, and of the various paintings and so on. So my children already have very substantial collections. And the rest of the paintings will all go to my children. It'll be up to them to dispose of them as they wish. So far, no Longfellow has ever sold a painting. We've only given them to museums. So that's the story there. So anyway, now I want to go back to Yale among my classmates. There was not only Seymour Knox and Thornton Wilder and Henry Luce, but I was an intimate friend of theirs all their lives. And as a matter of fact, next week, Seymour Knox has his 90th birthday, and I am considered a member of the family. And I want to show you the invitation to Seymour Knox's birthday.
Wow. Say
it again.
This is the portrait of Seymour Knox by Andy Warhol.
Oh, that's great.
Andy Warhol did that.
Very good.
And here's the invitation. You can see these are his children. See?
Uh-huh.
On September here we are. See, these are all his children and his grandchildren.
Aww.
Gene Seymour said he invites you for dinner in honor of Dad on his 90th birthday. Saturday, September the 10th, 98, at Seymour Knox at Siskay Forum.
Where is that?
That's
right outside of Buffalo.
Oh.
The Knox.
Seymour Knox.
Are you going there?
No. So anyway, I was going to go. I was going to go. Seymour called me up. I presented my answer. I was going to go. Seymour called me and said, Alec, I don't want you to come. I'll tell you why. I'm going to have my kids all for half a day. My children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren are all going to be there, and I won't have any time to spend with you. I want you to come a couple of weeks after that.
Oh,
spend a couple of days with me, see, and so on. So I'm not going, see.
That's very nice.
But by the same token, I must have seen Henry Luce 50 times. Had dinner with him and his wife. Tea with him, discussed everything with him. I was never able to get him to go to Israel. He was the son of a Christian missionary, and he was a very, very, shall I say, fundamentalist Christian, fundamentalist Republican. No two people could have been more unlike than Henry Luce and Alec Longfellow. Seymour Knox was very, very rich, but generous, kind. And I want to say this in my whole experience at Yale, and since then, this is 75 years I'm talking about, and they knew I worked my way through, they knew I was Jewish, I never once had any intimation that anybody had anything against Alec Longfellow. I was the class orator at the 50th reunion. I was the class orator at the 65th, that's the last reunion, which was about 3 years ago. I was chosen the class orator. I want you to know that. That's all the way through.
Mr. Knox from Buffalo, the Woolworth Air, obviously donated to the Albright Knox Museum.
They changed the name. It used to be the Albright Museum.
Oh.
When he built the new wing to it, and created, they changed it to the Albright Knox Museum. That's Seymour Knox. That's right.
Did he have an interest in art then, or is this?
He always did. Exactly. He and I talked over. He is the greatest collector in the world. Hear what I said? Of modern art.
Oh.
The greatest collector in the world of modern art is Seymour Knox.
And how did you learn your art other than just going and
I studied art.
Okay.
I actually studied in Pittsburgh and so on with Sam Rosenberg and other people. I actually studied. I can paint that. Oh, that's a drawing of mine. But I actually studied it. Uh-huh. I painted all my life.
And your wife?
I wanted to say a few things about my wife. My wife knew so much about art, although she never actually studied art. But she was very sensitive to it, you know, and so on. And I have just...
You said that Seymour was.
There you are. See the date of this letter? August the 8th, 1988.
Uh-huh.
See who was addressed? Abba Eban.
Ah.
Dear Abba. See the length of this letter?
Yes.
Here? All right. What's this letter about? Well, if you read the letter, Bear, I'll tell you about it. Of course, I knew him so well that Susie Eban, his wife, came from a very rich Egyptian Jewish family, and she had a very, very intense interest in art.
Oh.
She was a first-rate pianist, too, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Susie Eban was. Susie got interested in, was interested in these Carnegie Internationals, you know. So she came down and visited us for the opening of a Carnegie International, see? And the first prize, this was 40 or 45 years ago, the first prize was won by a man by the name of Philip Gustin, G-U-S-T-I-N. And Philip Gustin is the one who, in America, introduced abstract expressionism. And Susie Eban was so taken with him, and had taken her over to the opening of the show and so on and so on. She wanted to buy that first picture, see? But it wasn't for sale. A museum bought it, see? And so Susie then went to New York and bought Gustin. And when they were ambassador here, above the fireplace was that painting by Gustin, and in their home in Herzliya in Jerusalem, in Israel, that Gustin hangs there. So what's the poor business? 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, in the book review section, Gustin died about a year ago. His daughter wrote a biography of him. And since I read the review of the biography, so I knew Susie had bought it. That's the purpose of this letter. It's to tell her that the daughter wrote it. Susie didn't know it. And so and of course, I'm reminded of a couple of other things.
You wrote the letter to Susie?
To Abby, to her husband.
Abba, see. To Abba, I see.
Dear Abba,
okay.
You see, August the 8th. I haven't gotten an answer to this yet. See, I just said August the
8th. Are you typing this yourself?
Pardon?
Did you type this yourself?
Did I do what?
Did you type this yourself?
No, I didn't. I had somebody type it. See,
he writes so many longhand.
Yeah,
most of them are longhand. Well, this was
wonderful.
No, this took place. It takes four or five different things, different subjects. I think it's about Eban, see. And since I did, I figured my handwriting is so bad, and it would take three or four pages. So I had somebody type it into
it's
one thing.
It's lovely. Yeah.
How old were you when you retired?
I was on my 50th birthday, I retired.
On your 50th
birthday.
You were able to amass that much
well,
money.
Well, it wasn't that much. I never needed very much. Once I had acquired enough to take care of my children, and my ordinary needs, I retired. But I retired mainly for this reason. Of the top four in the family, my older brother and my sister, and my brother was younger than I am, Riel and Smith, died when they were under 50.
Oh.
When I got to be 50, I said, nothing doing.
Your brother and sister? Sir?
A few of them.
My sister, the one sister. This is of the top four of the family, you know, see? And they died. And three of them died under 50. And I decided, on my 50th birthday, I am retiring. That's all there is to it. And so I just retired. And I devoted myself only, as I had all my life, to public causes.
Do you think that's helped your longevity?
Pardon?
That was the reason for your longevity?
No. Everybody in the family. No member of my family ever lived this long.
Well, I mean, do you think because you retired?
All the rest of them died. Some were dead. Well, the younger ones have died. There are only three of us left now.
No, but the fact that you are lucky enough to...
You were the only one who retired that early. Is it,
yeah,
do you think
I'm
that made a difference in your longevity?
I don't know. How am I going to tell you?
Less
you
is wonderful.
Look, you can get killed. You can get a disease.
Sure.
How do you know? You never know what the hell causes anything to happen. Anyway, but what did I do with my life? As I said, in 1917, with the Balfour Declaration, and Brandeis begins to be active, and so on, I became active. But my father, I come by honestly, I told him about my father and grandfather. I know all about this stuff, see. And Saul Rosenblum took an interest in me, because I used to tell him about my father and my grandfather, and about Zionism and about things of this kind. See, here was a young Yale boy. His son didn't know a damn thing about it, see. But he was so glad that I was his son's friend, closest friend, see, you know, that we talked about it, and he wanted me to come here and so on and so forth. Anyway.
You did tell us that, and before we close, do you want to tell us a little bit more about Abe Fortas and the New Deal?
No, only about the New Deal, and that is
okay.
I was always very much interested in public causes, as well as charities and so on and so forth. And when Roosevelt was elected President of the United States, I was very much as I sort of worked in public causes here in Pittsburgh. And that is, when I first came to Pittsburgh, and I went into business here, Pittsburgh was a company town. And that is the U.S. Steel Corporation and the Consolidation Coal Company and the kind of, like, the things the Mellons were in and so on and so forth. They were company towns, and the people that worked for them, they had company stores, were almost like peons. And anybody who opened his mouth in dissatisfaction, or he wanted to start a union, or want to complain, or something like that, he would disappear, he'd be arrested, and put away, and so on and so forth. And the wife would come. And I made a couple of lectures here in Pittsburgh. I was a graduate of Yale Law School. Oh, by the way, I was also a member of the Yale debating team. I want you to know that. So I was articulate, too, see. And anyway, I came here, I made a couple of talks, and a couple of items appeared in the local papers, you know, about some of my views and so on and so forth. And I worked very, very hard to get rid of the company towns and company stores and company jails and company everything else, see. So by the time, there were always Republican administrations all the time I was here, you see. I come here in the end of 21 and right through to 32, you know, the Republican administrations. But anyway, Roosevelt gets in, and I had worked in the campaign locally here, just worked for the Democrats and so on and so forth. But I was interested all the time. In my interests, I became friendly with Leon Kaiserling. Leon Kaiserling he was a graduate of Columbia, and he was a graduate of Harvard Law School, and he was a good friend of mine. And Leon, after he graduated from Harvard Law School, taught economics at Columbia with Tugwell. And Tugwell was a great economic, you know, economist and so on, and he was a great backer of Roosevelt. So Leon got very much interested in Cameron. I got to know Leon, and Leon got me interested in the Roosevelt administration once it gets in, see. And Leon is the one who finally put together the Wagner Labor Relations Act. But prior to that, my wife, who graduated from Pitt, she graduated from Pitt when she was 18. She had a master's when she was 19, and she began to teach at Pitt when she was 20 or 21. In the field of labor relations and personal practices. They never had those fields in those days. But Edgar Kaufman had set up at Pitt a field for department stores and personal practices and so on, and my wife was taught that at Pitt. My wife was then taken by Macy's store in Toledo called the Sal and Cook. LaSalle and KOCH Cook as a personnel director. And then my wife delivered the main address of the National Retail Dry Goods Association right here in Pittsburgh in June of 1931 at the bottom of the Depression with her ideas of how to get everybody to work. It's the duty of government to get everybody to work. All with a all along the same lines of my thinking, see. How did I know her? When we built this building here, my wife was teaching at Pitt. And we opened this building in 1920. She was a tenant of mine. I didn't marry her until 1935, see, but she was a tenant of mine. She had the same kind of ideas I had. And I got to know her, you know, and went with her and so on and so forth. But anyway, she had all those same ideas that were incorporated later on in the Wagner Labor Relations Act. But it was Leon Keisling who wrote it. He became then the secretary to Senator Wagner, and I got to know him and his wife right through. His wife, by the way, was a secretary for Eleanor Roosevelt, and that connects me with Eleanor Roosevelt. See?
Senator Wagner's wife.
No, Leon Keisling's
wife.
Oh, Leon
Keisling's wife.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, when she was single. She made a liberal out of it, Eleanor Roosevelt. But anyway, I got to know them, and they were our closest friends. Leon died a little over a year ago, on August the 8th of the year. But all of them, and Mary Keisling, still our closest friends, and so on and so forth. And as he moved on, he, with the Roosevelt administration, he wrote all the New Deal Act, every one. The Agricultural Administration Act, so he worked with Tugwell. See, the Tugwell became part of Roosevelt's kitchen cabinet, see. And then Mary Keisling became, under Lyndon Johnson, the Assistant Secretary of Labor. But Leon wrote the Agricultural Act, the Housing Act, the Full Employment Act, all these acts, see? And Leon set up the Council of Economic Advisors for the President. And under Truman, he was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for the President of the United States. But Leon was an intense Jew. And Leon was interested in all the things that I was interested in from a Jewish point of view. But I used to go to Washington, see him all the time, and talk over all these acts. The only thing that I was finally slated to become the deputy administrator for the Point Four program in 1951. But Joe McCarthy got after me because I was a liberal. And I am one of the founders of Americans for Democratic Action, with Eleanor Roosevelt, with Hubert Humphrey, and with Joe Rao, and Arthur Schlesinger, and all of, and I am the first national treasurer, and on the first executive committee of the Americans for Democratic Action. But he thought that was communist. We were anti-communist, see? But he thought that with Joe McCarthy, and my friend Dean Acheson, who was at Yale and I was, and whose younger brother I tutored to get into Yale, I tutored his younger brother, who was my friend all my life. Dean asked me, Alec, take out your name. I have enough trouble with Joe McCarthy. Please get out of this Point Four program. So, you know. And so I didn't want to go on a government payroll anyway. See? I was always wanted to be free to express myself, because sometimes I differed with them on certain points of view and so forth. But anyway, but I was, from the very beginning, not only for that, I started all my Jewish activities when I first came to Pittsburgh, right in the very beginning. I was a Zionist. I worked for all the Jewish causes. And in 1938, 50 years ago, I was chairman of the United Jewish Federation campaign. 50 years ago. I want to record that.
Alex, we are just so awed by your life and by your accomplishments.
I want to tell you some of the things. I made a note of this thing. First, I want to go back to Yale again on Jewish thing. I am the founder, one of the founders of the Menorah Society at Yale, and I am one of the founders of the first Greek letter Jewish society, Pi Lambda Phi, at Yale. They didn't last very long, by the way, but I was one of the founders of these things. The Jews weren't taken into the Greek letter societies or anything like that at Yale, see, you know, so, or in the, right now you're reading about Skull and Bones, Bush of Skull and Bones. They didn't take any Jews, I can tell you right now, Skull and Bones. Then, today they may, I don't know. But anyway, that's that. Now, I did want to tell you also that while I was at Yale, and I was on the Law Journal, there was a classmate of mine by the name of Elliot Cohen. And Elliot Cohen was a literary writer, and he became one of the editors of the Yale Lit magazine. And he became the first editor of Commentary when Commentary was put out in 1945. Now remember, this 25 years after I graduated, see, what I'm trying to tell you about. And these friendships I told you about Yale, with Luce, for example. That's 25 years after I graduated. I'll show you a letter from him where he's going to meet me in Jerusalem at the King David Hotel 35 years after I graduated, see. And letters all the time. I wrote two top stories, one for the, two cover stories, one for Life magazine and one for Time magazine. I wrote the cover stories.
Now, this is a tape is going to end soon. And I was wondering whether, whether we could ask you one great question.
Go ahead. What?
If you look back on your life, Alex, and you've accomplished so much and you knew so many people and you've done so much, if you were to pick out one thing that you're the proudest of, that you feel is your greatest contribution,
I can tell you that. There's a picture right there. When I became the first national chairman of sales of the Israel bond issue. Do you remember I said national chairman of sales when the state is created and they were beginning to look for how can you finance a state? See? And I'd like to talk about that a little bit because it didn't just happen. It was because I had already been the national chairman of United Israel Appeal, the United Palestine Appeal, the United Jewish Appeal. I was the chairman of national chairman, you know, of speakers and everything else. I was one of Ben Gurion's boys and so on. And I was in on all of these things. But most people aren't aware of the fact you just couldn't come into the United States and float an issue of $500 million. You had to go through the SEC, you know, and you had no history of credibility. And I was one of those who had an awful lot to do with Judge Simon Rifkin and Leon Kaiserling, and we got the thing through the SEC. And I was the first national chairman of sales. And I traveled for many years before that, all over the country with Golda Meir, with the Vice President of the United States, with all the great speakers that we brought over, with Ben Gurion, Charette, Eliezer Kaplan, Golda Meir. I had traveled for years and years across the United States, talking about raising money and so on and so forth, and so on. And organizing communities in Canada and the United States. I went to England to try to do it there. I failed there, but I went there anyway. I was
sorry. Why did you fail in England?
The government of England would not permit this kind of sale.
The tax-free.
They have it now, see?
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have it in those days. But anyway, that's the high point of my life, I would say. But when I think of some of the intimate things, for example, my relationship with Ben Gurion, when the question of the law of the return comes up, and I'm there with him. You know, the question of that's the relationship with the outside, with the galut, the world, the law of the return. And Ben Gurion said to me, he says, how would you interpret and define who is a Jew? And I said to him, I have pictures of this discussion, by the way. I said, you will never accept because you'll never be able to get it through. My answer is, to me, anybody who is willing to appear in Israel and swear publicly, I don't care what his color is, what his sex is, or what he says, I am a Jew, that's enough for me. Then Gurion said, you know, I'll never get away with that, my son. No, you won't, see. But anyway, they finally did make it vague enough so that if you were converted by a Reform rabbi, they haven't been able to change the law. They've been trying, the Orthodox have been trying to change the law for 40 years, but they haven't been able to change the law yet. That's still the definition of who is a Jew, see. I only hope that there's a new movement started in Israel right now, what they call the pluralistic movement. It doesn't make any more kind of Jew. Just because you're a Jew, that should be enough, see. But they haven't been able to change the law, that's the law. But anyway, I want to tell you some of the things that I've been, in Pittsburgh, for example, I've been on the board of every Jewish organization, from Jewish Federation, YMHA, Jewish Center,
PCIA.
Social Service Bureau. I don't know whether And my wife is a life member. Oh, Jewish Home for the Aged. By the way, I'm a life member of the Jewish Home for the Aged. My wife, we she's a life member of the Moniker Hospital, you know, life trustee of Moniker Hospital, and so on and so forth. And we organized all of these things, see, and we created them, and we were members of the board of them for years and years and years, 30, 40, 50 years, I guess. But in addition to that, I am a founder and an original board member of the Pittsburgh Council for International Visitors. I am also a founder and a board member of the Pittsburgh Chamber Music Society. So is my wife, a member of that. See, my wife was a member of the Child Guidance Center here in Pittsburgh. And all things. We were in all kinds of Jewish and non-Jewish social movements all our lives, always involved in and so on.
Just to end, do you have any thoughts of how this can perpetuate any